Hello, welcome to Growing Wild. I am Charlotte Petz and you're listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, on DAB and online at radioreverb.com. On today's show, we have got Jane Mutiny, the brilliant street artist. Clara Nissen takes us around her Halloween-themed allotment plot and tells us a brilliant community story of how they've managed to save their patch. And finally, Joe White takes us around the field that her local community have bought and are doing brilliant things with. Now, first off, we're going to have a song. So the title of the show is called Mutiny, which is quite an extravagant title for the slightly milder content it contains, other than the fact, obviously, that Jane Mutiny is on the show. But for that reason, I've chosen this as the opening song because I love it and I've gotten completely obsessed with Peaky Blinders. I just watched all of them. I've become very numb to quite extreme violence, which is a worry. So this is Red Right Hand by Nick Cave, which you may recognise from the opening credits of Peaky Blinders.
Where secrets lie in the border fires and the humming wires, yeah, man, you know you're never coming back. Past the square, past the bridge, past the mills, past the stacks. On a gathering storm comes a tall, handsome man in a dusty black coat with a red right hand.
That's Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds with Red Right Hand. What a tune. And I don't know why I like Tommy Shelby, but I do. Okay, the first person we have coming up on today's show is Jane Mutiny, who is a street artist. She specialises in massive... Now, this is a word that I struggle with that you will hear. Murals. Oh, I did it first time. They're very sizable. And she paints often species that are endangered or already extinct. So it's very nature-focused art. You may have seen it quite recently. Actually, she did a massive one for Extinction Rebellion a couple of weeks ago in London, which picked up quite a lot of coverage, I believe. I met her at the Oceans Film Festival. We've got a couple of mutual friends. And then the very next day, I went to go and see her at the Sussex Wildlife Trust over at Woods Mill, where she was doing a commission for them. They've got a new little cafe there, and it's a horse box. She was there mutinying that horse box up. So I went along to go and find her. There was, unusually for a nature reserve, quite a lot of tree felling going on. Unfortunately, they too have succumbed to the ash dieback. So two beautiful old ashes were being cut down while we were there. So there was a little bit of chainsawing that we were trying to escape from, which we managed to do. And then we ended up next to quite a busy road. So, you know, swings and roundabouts. Anyway, here's Jane explaining more about the kind of art that she creates.
So I'm here at the Wildlife Trust painting a converted horse box that will be a cafe. And I'm adorning it with a bullfinch and a grass snake as decoration.
It's very good. That's my expert opinion. You've done some other stuff here too for them, haven't you? Over on the... I mean, I don't want to... It doesn't sound glamorous to say you painted the bogs, but essentially...
Yeah, I mean, they're the most glamorous toilets in all of Sussex, I think. I'm very proud of that. What a thing to put on my CV.
I know. I think it's quite remarkable, actually.
Paint anyone's toilets. I'm available for all toilet painting.
Well, your work is really striking. It's got really... Let's just do it somewhere else.
Yeah.
Got a little bit in front of the horse box.
I mean, I could ask them to stop for 5 minutes. How long will it take?
It feels bad. I mean, they're up a massive tree.
Yeah.
It seems a little bit like,
guys,
mate, can you just hold it for 20? Is that...
Yeah.
Okay. We'll just hide around the back of this.
Yeah. What are you doing?
Yeah, who are you? Have you got permission?
Mm-hmm. No.
Your work is very striking.
Thank you.
How would you describe it?
When I decided to sort of paint large scale, everything took off from there. Because I was living in East London at the time, so that was an easy place to start with street art, because it's such a huge thing there. There's a lot of it in Shoreditch and East London, you know, and Bethnal Green where I'm living, and Hackney. And so it was an easy transition for me to do that, really. Mm. My first mural was in Dorset, though. I did it in my friend's workshop. I did a big pheasant. 20-foot pheasant, which she named Bert, and he's still there apparently. But I decided at some point after that that I was going to do endangered animals, and that was then my focus mostly. And when I'm working, you know, for the Wildlife Trust, I tend to do British species, of course, and they're not all endangered. But at the same time, it's almost like you can't really get complacent about what isn't endangered. It's all under threat, really.
Yeah.
Realistically, if you're looking at it like that. But yes, my focus tends to be on endangerment.
When you say street art, mm-hmm. does that mean you were doing it as kind of like a graffiti artist? Does that mean were you doing it under the letter of the law, or is that something you can answer?
You mean, am I a criminal?
Are you a criminal?
I'm a crim. No, I'm not. Well, no, actually, that's not true. I have painted once where I shouldn't have probably painted, but you know, I mean, it's funny enough, actually, that day when I walked out with a ladder and some paint, two policemen walked past me on the towpath. And they didn't even bother. They were just chatting away. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just...
Your heart's getting good.
Yeah, I was like, they're going to nick me. And then they just walked past. They obviously didn't care. I mean, there's bigger things to worry about in Hackney than street art.
Yeah, sure.
Vandalism. But no, I don't actually do that. That's the first and only time I've ever done that.
Okay.
I always get permission.
Yeah, yeah.
Because not only is that, you know, obviously it's the right thing to do, but also if you get permission to paint a wall, then the work is yours.
Mm.
And that's, there's no two ways about that.
I imagine it's much less stressful as well.
Yes.
I mean, you'd just be constantly like, oh my God.
No, I was terrified when I thought those policemen were coming back for me. They didn't.
Yeah, but, not a relaxing afternoon.
No, it's not.
And when you do I'm really bad at saying this word.
Murals.
Murals. Mural.
Mural.
Oh my God. Total mental block to say.
Mural.
Mural. Yeah. Mural. Sounds weird. We're talking quite a big scale here. What's the biggest one you've done?
The biggest wall I've ever painted was quite recently, a couple of weeks ago, in Shoreditch, actually, which was a wall I did for Extinction Rebellion. And it was a huge, huge wall, 16 metres by 7.5. Old brick wall, which was just covered in about 10 years' worth of layers of paint. And it was, you know, it was a nightmare, actually. It was quite a difficult wall. It was actually my most difficult job. For various reasons, because obviously they had to shut the pavement, they had to have barriers out, they had to get banksmen who were stopping people from walking into the road and getting run over by buses, and I was up a scissor lift and it was terrifying. And you know, when you're up a wall, up a scissor lift, and you're looking down at a double-decker bus, you know you're high up.
Yeah, I mean, how do you approach that scale-wise? How do you know which bit you're doing at any one time? Do you have to go up and do a bit and then come back and cross the road and get perspective on it? And is there a lot of that going on?
Yes, there is. I mean, I was getting my boyfriend to go and go into the hotel opposite, go up on the balcony and take a photo and WhatsApp it to me. And then I knew... Because when you're further away, you can obviously see what you're doing much easier and the whole thing. So he was doing that, and then that was quite helpful. But actually, I gridded the whole thing, which took ages, meter by meter, gridded it, and then I gridded up my picture and I did it that way.
And now everything since then feels pretty easy.
I mean, yeah, I said to you earlier, didn't I?
Yeah.
This job I'm doing here at Woods Mill in Sussex is the first time I'm using enamels on metal, which is, and this, it's quite, gloss paint is quite a difficult medium because it gets everywhere and it stays on you and it stains everything and it's just messy and drippy. And I've never used it before and never painted on metal, so I'm a bit like nervous. But now I'm just like, well, if I can paint a massive wall in Shoreditch, you know, over 4 days in the rain, then I'm fine.
I've got this. I have got this.
Yeah.
Are you quite careful about the materials you use then? Because obviously you've got such a strong environmental core to you, just to your being.
Yeah, I never use spray paint for that very reason. Yeah. So I can't, you know, when Village Underground offered the wall with XR for me to do, I've said to them, you know, I'm going to be using just paint. And they thought I was mad. And I probably am. But I can't bring myself to use spray paint. A, because I can't anyway. I'm rubbish at it. But also, there's so much waste from it. Not only, you know, the atmospheric, you know, stuff, but also the waste from the plastic that's left over from the caps and things. Like, they're not recyclable easily.
Okay.
So I just think it's better to use acrylics and sort of masonry paint. Although, obviously, this enamel paint I'm using is... pretty toxic.
But
good to know. I'll just pour my white spirit into the river, it'll be fine.
Yeah, I think that's fine. Yeah, why not? You know, we can only do so much.
I'm not gonna do that, guys. I'm just to let you know. I won't do that.
Where do you think, I don't know that it's often that easy to pinpoint the origin of what you just feel passionate about, but Was there anything that happened that made you be particularly interested in the environment and in nature, and for that to be the direction you went in with your art?
Yeah, actually, I can pinpoint one point actually in 2011, or maybe 2012, when I really figured that's what I wanted to do. But when I was young, I mean, I grew up in Dorset, so I always had nature around me. I was bird watching from a young age and identifying things and going out every day into the woods near my house. And I was always absorbed into nature and living by the coast as well. So that was always part of me anyhow. And I was always painting animals. But then in 2011, I went to India with my friend, and it's a trip we've been planning for ages. And we went finally, and we went on a tiger safari, and we saw a wild tiger, and he walked out in front of the car, and it was completely silent, and there were a couple of other cars, and we were watching him, and he was a big male Bengal tiger, and he had a full belly, so we knew we weren't in that much danger. Well, no, obviously you are when you're around a tiger.
Sure.
But still, he was
get complacent.
No. Yeah, that's right. Don't get out of the car. But no, it was he was so close to us. He was probably about 3 meters away from the car, and I was just totally overwhelmed with the feeling that this was a completely special moment. I would never get an opportunity like this again. And I snapped a very shaky photo of him, and then me and my friend were crying and hugging, and then he wandered off, and it was honestly about a minute he was in our presence, and then he wandered off into the bush and was gone. As soon as he walked behind a tree, you couldn't see him.
Wow.
And it was incredible. And that moment completely changed my life, because from that photo that I took, I then painted an ink painting. I was using ink back then for my friend, and I gave it to her as a gift in a frame. And she's got it on her wall in her living room. And I just, from that moment, I was like, I have to paint endangered animals now. Because that is, you know, I was just so aware of how rare that moment was.
It's quite a visceral reaction as well. I think when you get such a physical reaction to something, it's usually telling you something, isn't it? You've got to pay attention to that.
Absolutely. God, yeah. And I do try that, and, you know, try and use my intuition in that way. Because I find myself really deeply moved by nature and anything in the natural world. So,
art-wise, is that something that's just been part of your life forever as well?
Yeah, definitely. I've always been drawing since a very young age. In fact, my mum has still got on her key rings. She's still got for her house keys, she's got a little fob which has got a tiny, tiny picture in it on one side of two rabbits, and on the other side a tiny picture of two birds that I drew. I remember doing them. I must have been about three, I suppose, or four. And these two little bunnies, and they're really, obviously they're rubbish, but they're just, it's really cute that she's still got that on her key ring.
Probably about my level, to be honest. If I was to do that, yeah. Maybe about on par.
My dad showed, or my mum maybe showed me a trick of how to draw birds' feet when they're sat on a wire, just like three little lines to show the feet. And I was trying to get them like right underneath the birds, and I couldn't do it, and they were like, so the birds were here and the lines were sort of further along.
Oh.
The feet were separate. And
I remember
feeling very frustrated about that.
And do you feel like your art is your way of contributing and helping, and because of the scale of which you do things as well, then people can't help but pay attention. And I guess this feels like it's your way of just helping to raise awareness, and it's your way of contributing to this whole situation.
Yeah, definitely. And because, I mean, I think it's hard to, you know, not feel helpless in this sort of situation, this current climate we're in. It's really awful.
Yeah.
And you know, so we're all trying to do our bit, and my way is to raise awareness through my art. That's the only thing I know how to do. And I love doing it, and also because art is, it really does engage people, and you're constantly finding projects where art meets science, and they often work so well because, you know, the facts and the science and the technology behind the real situation is put with art, which then somehow it brings it together in something that's quite tangible for the public, you know. And especially with that's actually one of the reasons I do public art and mural work, is because I like the idea that you can bring art to the people rather than bring people to the art in a gallery, you know, which is great too, but it does kind of, it has a certain clientele, I think, and not everyone,
unfortunately,
feels,
still there's a lot of work going into changing that, I think, but it does
is,
still have a very
there's a stigma attached to it, I think, and it's unfortunate, but street art doesn't have that. It's available for everybody, and I've been told that actually by members of the public, and they're always so grateful. They come and talk to me. I actually always now I have to factor in into my time that I'm going to spend on a project, I have to factor in the amount of time I stop and talk to people. It's fun for me to do that, and you know, sometimes I'll get people. I painted in Brixton, painted a African wild dog on the side of a building, and this this man came along, this African man, and he was like, oh, I remember those from my childhood. And, you know, it's comments like that that are just so, they make it totally worthwhile. If we can inspire in some way, then I think that's doing a good job.
That's Jane Mutiny there. If you are in the West Sussex area and do need a wee, then do go and check out the toilets that she's painted at Woods Mill Nature Reserve at the Sussex Wildlife Trust. They're brilliant. And her work generally is really, truly quite something. And you can see it on janemutiny.com if you want to go and have a look at that. And as she said, she is available for commissions, whether that be toilet or massive wall. Okay, so we're going to have a song, and in tribute to Jane, because we that conversation, as always, you know, these conversations are so long and I have to whittle them down and try and get the good bits out of them, but they're all good, so it's always a challenge. But she talked about how some of her inspiration came from Ted Hughes and some of the poetry and the prose that he wrote about crows. So I wanted to play a song that reflected that, and so I'm going to play Black Crow by Joni Mitchell.
There's a crow flying, talking ragged tree to tree. He's black as the highway that's leading me. Now he's diving down to pick up on something shiny. I feel like that black crow flying in a blue sky.
Quite a long outro on that song. That's Black Crow with Joni Mitchell. You're listening to Radio Reverb. I'm Charlotte Petz, and this is Growing Wild. Next up on the show, we have Clara Nissen. And now, we met because she interviewed me for a show called Podcast Radio Hour, which went out on Radio 4 Extra a few weeks ago. And it transpired that she had an allotment plot. And it was quite a good story. They'd come up with inventive ways to essentially save their plots from the threat of development, which is a story we hear quite frequently, unfortunately. Allotments, they can be a bit of an easy target. So I know, I mean, way back we had Craven Vale allotments on, who are more local to Brighton, and they were talking about how they were under threat. And I think they're still hanging on, they're still clinging on to their plots. So, but it's just a horrible feeling to have this kind of axe over your head the whole time. So we're going to hear from Clara explaining a little bit more about the plots and why they're so special to her. And then later on, we'll hear a couple of voices where she's actually on the plot and going around and meeting some other allotment holders. Now, I've called this show Mutiny, as I said, quite a grand title, just because these all feature women either called Mutiny, which is handy, or people who have just put their foot down and said no and saved these little bits of land and brought their communities together and worked really hard to preserve what they love. So that to me feels slightly mutinous and not just going with the big guy and letting them get away with whatever they want, really. This is Clara, and she explains more about their plight.
I've had a plot for about 5.5, 6 years. Northfields Allotments, which is in Ealing. And I believe, or we believe, that it is the oldest allotment site in London, 1820s or 1830s, and to our knowledge, no other allotment site in London is older than that.
Wow.
So, and it's quite a special place.
Yeah.
It's got a few quirks.
Yeah.
So, for example,
is it haunted?
at one end, there's a house built on what would naturally be part of the allotments. And it turns out that the reason for this is that the allotments, which were originally common land, had someone who'd been living there in his caravan for, you know, so long that he made the argument that it was now his land. And sure enough, they gave him the land after a bit of a fight. So there's sort of some interesting little historical quirks about the site, which is lovely.
Am I right in thinking that they came under threat at some point from development?
Yes. So the allotments are owned and run, or they were run anyway, they're certainly owned by a conglomerate of charities now called Pathways. And they run a lot of sheltered housing for the council. They own the two local allotment sites, one of those is ours, Northfield Allotments. They've actually already built on, in the 70s, I think it was, they built on half of the allotments. So we've already lost half the allotments that were there.
Right.
And as of a few years ago, they decided they wanted to build more sheltered housing. More sheltered housing is great, but on our allotments, just one end of the site. But, you know, we could see that this would just be creeping further and further. And of course, any lost allotments are permanently lost forever. We really rallied round. We put together a management team. So we came under self-management. It just, the site wasn't really being looked after. But since we've taken over self-management, it's now had its new lease of life. The plot holders are really looking after their plots and making the most of them. The list has gone right down from 4, 5, 6 year waiting list down to about 2 years, or if not less. One of the other great things about it is that in order to raise money to fight the potential development, we started having open days. They happen twice a year. One of them is in the summer, early summer.
Yeah.
And one of them is at Halloween. And it's a great chance for us to connect with the wider community and invite them into the allotments to give them a sense of ownership over the allotments, and a feeling that they too are involved and that the allotments are important for the whole community.
Yeah, because when you have to try and save these things, you need as many people as possible on your side and on board, don't you? Especially if it's getting pitched as, well, it's housing and we need housing. That is quite a difficult argument, I would imagine, in some minds. Of, you know, if people don't have a connection to the allotments and don't understand the importance of them, then they could easily be dismissed.
I was surprised actually how positive everyone was about saving the allotments.
Mm.
Even people living in sheltered accommodation. I mean, if you've ever been around my area, you can see that there's lots of land that brownfield sites, which are more expensive to build on than greenfield sites, like our allotments.
Right.
And of course aren't owned currently by pathways. But, you know, there's a lot of sites that could be being built on, but aren't.
And so of course, they're an easy target.
Easy pickings.
Yeah. So you fought for them, you saved them. Is it an ongoing process of having to continually fight to save them, or is that part as the threat passed, do you think?
We think that the threat has gone away for now, but we think it's going to just keep coming back again and again.
Okay.
I mean, it's just too tempting a sight.
Okay, so it's something that's just sort of hovering above your head. So tell me about the Halloween event that you've got. It's imminent. I think next weekend it will be here.
Yeah.
What happens?
So it happens on the last Saturday before Halloween. And we open the allotments just before it gets dark, and it's open for about 4 hours. And we've all decorated our plots with Halloween-y, scary, spooky things like, you know, skeletons and light shows and whatever. And we light up the paths with pumpkins, hollowed out pumpkins and little tea lights. We have cake stall, we have a mulled wine stall, we have all sorts of stalls selling produce, chutneys and things that we've made from our produce.
Oh, great.
We've got a soup stall as well.
So how is your own personal squash growing gone this year? You had a good haul, or are you off to Sainsbury's?
It's been a bit of a disappointing year this year.
It's been tough, isn't it, for squashes?
So much. Yeah. Sorry, what was that?
It's just been quite a tough year for squashes. I've noticed that. There's not been that many around.
On our allotments, we're all encouraged to grow pumpkins for the for the Halloween pumpkin trail. And, you know, so we're used to seeing lots of orange globes around the place, but there just aren't that many this year.
Yeah.
They haven't been quite as productive as usual, but we've still got lots of them.
And you've basically found a way to be autonomous, and that is just brilliant and has saved you.
Yeah, and also it's connected us to, I think just as importantly, it's connected us to
the community.
the community, and also it's brought us a lot of new plot holders, because a lot of people who've come and seen the allotments have ended up going on the waiting list.
What does the allotment mean to you? How is it? What's it brought to your life?
Well, I've always loved growing things and been drawn to plants and nurturing plants, and it's my sort of. It's something I think about all the time. Somewhere I go in my head, even if I'm not there, to find sort of solace and interest. And when I'm going to sleep, if I've got troubles on my mind, I'll just take myself mentally to the allotment and think about, the sun there, or the weather and the plants that I've got growing, and just being outside. So it's definitely something that's on my mind the whole time, really, knowing that it's there. But when I'm there, it's also, it's just a great way of getting me outside, really.
Yeah.
I'd otherwise be a bit of a sofa junkie, I think. But, yeah.
You were on your allotment this weekend, and you very kindly picked up a few little recordings from some other people who were there, who were setting up for this Halloween event. So we're going to hear some voices from your plot, which will be lovely.
Yep, so I went to talk to my friend Fran, who used to have a plot nearby me, a sort of half plot, but she got moved to a full plot when one came available. She works it along with her daughter Marianne, and then I went and met a plot holder who I haven't actually met before, who's called Nicola, and her mum Gillian.
We're going to hear from them just in a moment. A key bit of that link that I did not put in at the beginning is the fact that they have this big Halloween event, which is a huge fundraiser for the committee that runs the plot. I also don't know if any of you noticed that when we started talking about Halloween, there was some maniacal laughter happening in the background, which I thought was spookily well-timed. Creepy. Okay, let's hear from some of the people on Clara's Pot as they set up for this event. And the first people we hear are Nicola and Gillian, as Clara settles down into their shed.
So the tea is on. Oh, thank you very much.
Tea's on.
I've got the really nice seat, and you guys have just gone.
We had you have another seat.
We're used to this. So how long have you been involved in the Halloween pumpkin trail?
Since it started.
This is our third year.
Yes, it will be our third year. We decorated the plot last year.
We did.
Which, we're not really Halloween people, but it's kind of, it's a time thing. If you have the time, you should help. Yeah. And so I try to come to the volunteer days.
Yeah, I don't come
Mum
to the volunteer
days.
I live in Kingston. Okay, it's a bit far.
So Mum always comes and does the cake stall.
I do the money on the cake stall, always. Right. I do it for the open days and I do it for the Halloween thing.
Yeah.
I look after the money, that's fine. I'm okay with that.
It's a big earner, isn't it?
It is. It's surprising how much money it takes, actually. It's quite... how much money people are willing to pay for a piece of cake.
Really? People are here to have a good time. They're here to look at what we're doing. They're here to spend some money.
And they're here to bring their children on the Halloween thing.
It falls over half term, so it's quite a nice one to do. I mean, last year we had lots of children come dressed up, which was really nice.
Yeah.
And it's free entertainment, basically, isn't it? Well, and if you want to spend money on cake, well, that's great for us.
Absolutely.
I think the best thing has been Christina's philosophy that nobody should pay to come and look at the allotment. Christina's our the chair of the association, and she's really, really good about wanting this to be a place where local people can come and see green space. It's not just about the plot holders.
No.
She has worked really hard to open it up to the community and show people what we do and why it's important.
Good mood,
And I mean, I know I have friends who are local who have children, and the children are really excited. In fact, I have two volunteer helpers for decorating the plot next Saturday morning because they are so excited, and they're really excited to take their grandparents to it, you know. But I do know that last year the chip shop ran out of chips, The local chip shop.
Well, after we
ran out of chips,
yeah.
And the Foresters, which is the pub on the corner, they love the open day because they get so much extra business. So
it's
really nice that we've been able to do something that's good for us. It's good for the allotments, but that like local businesses and the local community really appreciate it. And I think that's what we should be doing.
So I'm here on the plot of Fran, my good friend, and her daughter Marianne. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
So we're here to talk about the Halloween pumpkin trail. Marianne, how old are you?
Eight.
She'll be nine on Friday.
Nine on Friday. Okay, so nearly nine. What have you decided what you're going to dress up as this year?
Kylo Ren from Star Wars.
Have you got everything you need for the outfit?
They're your pyjamas, aren't they?
Yep.
Kylo Ren pyjamas. Well, it's got a cape and everything.
Last year, Fran, you were dressed as a very green witch.
I was a very green witch. I was full green makeup, big billowy dress.
Quite, what's her name out of Wicked?
Yes. Elphaba.
Yes, that's right. And how are you decorating your plot?
We've got spider and some skeletons and bones.
And gravestones that we made ourselves, right? And they've got things on like Ealing born, Ealing bred, now I lie here Ealing dead. And another one that just says the patriarchy.
Marianne, what do you like best about the Halloween pumpkin trail?
I like giving out sweets.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. I like giving out sweets on Halloween too. I love that. I think it just beautifully encapsulates what an allotment site can be. And it brings in all of these different people from the community. You've got all ages involved. And even the local chippy can run out of chips because of an event that gets put on. So big respect to Northfield's allotment in Ealing, and thank you, Clara, for that excellent reporting from the field. Okay, we're going to have a song, and then we're going to be back with another brilliant community story, which looks more into the rewilding of a community space. But first, let's have, as requested by Clara, actually, Gaia Sue, because it makes her feel chipper. That was Pat Thomas and the Kwashiwu Area Band with Gaia Sue. You're listening to Radio Reverb. This is Growing Wild. I'm Charlotte Petz. And last up on this show, we have Jo White. She is a member of the East Chilterton Trust. And East Chilterton is a little village out in East Sussex. And they have come together and brilliantly bought a field at the back of their village and are now looking to see what they can do with that space. Me and Jo met at a course run by the Sussex Wildlife Trust, who are featured quite heavily in this show. Quite coincidentally, but that is how it goes sometimes. We were both on this course called Intro to Wilding, which basically focused in on how you rewild a space, essentially, and how we as individuals can help to do that, whether you've got quite a large garden, perhaps, or a field, like in this instance, or maybe a small holding or something like that. It was really, really good. And if you're interested in things like that, they will be running more. So do check out the Sussex Wildlife Trust if you are interested. So this conversation is me and Jo. We're walking out in the field. I went out to East Chilterton to meet her because I had to go and see it. And she explains the scenario in which they bought it and what they're trying to achieve now with this space. Oh, and it was windy, so apologies for that background gusting.
Left, right, through the middle, we can walk anywhere we like. We could kind of walk that way and then take in the orchard and then kind of walk the perimeter.
Okay. So we just walked into the field. It's quite a big space. How big is this?
Yeah, 20 acres.
20 acres.
Yeah.
Okay, and there's a few mowed lines going through it, which I imagine is where you're trying to direct people.
I think the correct term is a sort of permissive rights of way that have been formed from people coming out of the Hollycroft, the little kind of walkway that we just used to walk across the field and then
lots of people like to walk their dogs around the lake in the woods, which is just next door, which is absolutely amazing. So there is a public footpath that runs across the land, and it's the entrance, the start of the footpath is opposite the Jolly Sportsman pub, and it comes actually the other side of the hedgerow, and then it pops into our field about there, and it roughly follows this lovely line of oak trees that you can see, which at one point would have been the boundary this was two fields, and then it goes over the railway line just there.
As a community, mm-hmm. you came together, as I understand it, mm-hmm. you came together, you had some money in the parish account fund, and you bought a field.
Yeah, what a great idea.
It essentially got saved from development. This was being queued up for a nice bit of housing or some form of development, is that right?
I couldn't possibly comment on that, but I think there might have been rumours.
Yeah. Okay.
One would expect in overcrowded southeast England, where land is at such premium, and as we were talking about before, there is a really big housing need, one would expect that there would be a lot of developers interested in any bit of land that they might be able to see.
And what you're planning to do with this field, so you've got all this 20 acres... And it's beautiful. Mm. It is surrounded by these gorgeous layers of trees.
Yeah.
And you've got a few allotment plots in there as well.
Yeah.
What are you trying to do with this place? What are you thinking you're going to develop?
Yeah, well, wilding seems to be the thing that we're thinking about most at the moment. So I suppose since I've lived here, which is now 8-9 years, I think... the field has been rented out to one of our local farmers who have taken an yearly, sometimes twice yearly, crop of hay to make silage. In return for that, that farmer's then looked after hedges and ditches. So basically the field's been managed in a, you know, traditional agricultural sense, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So I suppose in response to the times that we're living in, really, a few of us on the tech committee have been thinking about... Is there an opportunity for the field to do a bit more for wildlife? We did a survey in the field earlier this year, and we were just looking at plant life, and we surveyed the sort of diversity of species in the orchard and in this middle strip, which hasn't been mowed for a little while. And there was a huge amount of different grasses, different plants. Because of that, we saw different pollinators, different insects. And of course, we compared that to the main body of the field, which has been mowed and, you know, farmed. And of course, the diversity here is really, really limited.
Have pesticides been used on this as well? Yeah,
I think very, very lightly, yes. And it has been fertilised as well. Okay. So really, we started to learn. Now, we're really lucky to have Fran Southgate. Well, she's an old friend of mine, which is my connection to her, but really lucky to have her expertise right on our doorstep. So
from the Sussex Wildlife Trust.
From Sussex Wildlife Trust, yeah, absolutely brilliant. So I chatted, I actually bumped into Fran at a friend's party, and we started to chat about the field, and I was reminded of her work for the trust. And she came over and we had a walk around, as we are now, and she said, well, the good thing is that you're kind of, in terms of wildlife habitat, you're starting at a baseline here of nothing. So anything you do from here on in is a bonus.
Right.
So I knew that, but hearing somebody with expertise say that was a bit like, oh God.
Oh.
So the problems that she identified, or let's say the issue, you know, that she identified is that we've got this, round the edges of the field, there are very tall trees, and then there's nothing until you hit the very short grass, which is treated with fertiliser, mown, farmed. So that's a really that's not a useful habitat for any kind of wildlife.
So this is the deception that I think a lot of people can get drawn
into,
and I certainly have done definitely fallen foul of that. All you see is green. We're looking out onto just so much green. You just assume that a lot of things will be living in that, and it's just naturally going to be a good thing for habitat. But actually, because of the human management of it, we've removed a lot just by making these sharp lines everywhere.
Sharp lines and lack of diversity. And you're absolutely right. And I think that's the exciting thing that's changing at the moment, because, you know, the crisis of our times is so finally landed in the mainstream, hasn't it? So where once people would have looked at this and gone, oh, green and pleasant land, this is how we're kind of programmed to think that nature works.
We've written songs about this.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, really beautiful. It's so neat, isn't it? It's like a big lawn. Everybody loves a lawn.
Everyone loves a lawn.
And then these lovely trees kind of fringing the edges. I'm really keen to reinstate this hedge line. So we're proposing, we're working with the farmer on this as well. We don't want this to be something that's becomes a polarity. So it's either rewilding or it's agricultural use. Maybe there could be a bit of a combination of those two things, but maybe we have to adapt on what that actually could look like. So
have you come up against any friction with the farmer? Because only because of such a because often farmers have come through with a very set way of doing things, and that's just how it is, and that's, you know, that's their way, and that's okay because it's their way. But yeah, when you're trying to do something like this, have you, is there a little bit of push and pull there?
Well, I think understandably there's a concern that as the farmers still take a crop from this for silage, that the yield will go down if we don't use pesticides and fertilizer. So that's completely understandable. So what we're trying to do is work with them to say, well, okay, if it gets to the point where that crop goes is reduced to the point where it's not worth you taking a yield, is there a more contractual relationship we can have with you where we pay you to come in and take the cut because we kind of need this area to be still cut for a while. Having said that, it was interesting what we learned on the course was when we mow something, it becomes uniform. When we allow animals to strip graze it, they'll nibble around certain things. They won't disturb the anthills. They'll kind of integrate a bit more with their environment. So there's all sorts of possibilities. But basically what we've kind of agreed on as a committee so far is that we will reinstate this hedge line, these three line of three glorious oaks that spans all the way across a pretty much a diagonal line across the field. And we'll do that by having a no-mow zone, which extends to the widest tip of the widest point of the canopy. So I think it's about 26 metres. I'm sorry, my dog's really
The dog's like, why aren't we walking?
So
we can walk a bit.
And as you'd already see in this the thin no-mow zone strip that's already there, already it's full of oak saplings. Already it's full of more diversity of grass. Yeah. Already, when we walked there in the summer, it was full of pollinators.
Have you given yourselves... Because, you know, you might have some people who are a little bit reticent about doing it. Is there a time limit that you're having to put on it? Are you saying, look, give us 5 years and let's just see? Or is it less than that? Or
So year one, the plan will be to create, I think, what Fran calls fuzzy edges.
Yes.
Round the perimeter of the field. So that means the tall trees and the short grass will change that shape from almost like a right angle, isn't it? Yeah. You could put a, you know, or whatever that.
What are they called?
It's not
a protractor.
Right angles.
I think it probably is right.
So you could stick that there, and it would all kind of fit in really well. So by not mowing an area of about 7 meters around the edge of the field, will allow the fuzzy edge to reinstate itself. So rather than tall tree, short grass, we'll get tall tree, medium-sized trees, loads of thicket and shrubs and, you know, coming down to taller grasses, taller plants, eventually coming down to shorter grass.
Yeah.
So that, we understand, is going to be already a massive boost to wildlife habitat.
Yeah,
plus there'll be tons of food.
Shrubland is where it's at, and that's the bit that we seem to like to remove quite happily. Yeah.
Exactly, because it's not tidy.
It's not tidy.
And the no-mow zone I was talking about in the middle, which will reinstate the old field boundary. Again, it's a no-mow zone. As the acorns take root and become seedlings, they will then be surrounded by naturally occurring brambles and spiky plants that act as a tree nursery. So there's an interesting thing here, isn't there, about to what extent we actively or passively rewild the field.
Yeah.
So
and sometimes we do need to put in a little bit of our intervention because we've put so much in to remove the wildness. It's like, well, of course it's going to make sense that we're going to have to just guide it back a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that said, and I don't think there's a right or wrong here, and it's certainly not for me to dictate that to the whole village, but my personal feeling is when we're talking about rewilding the field or wilding the field, who knows which one of those is the best term to use, I don't know. When we're talking about that, of course, it's massively important for the field itself to increase wildlife habitat, to be as diverse as possible, to be a highway. you know, it links up. We're not doing this in isolation. This links up with work that's being done all over the county and all over the country to create wildlife corridors and pollinator highways, because we know that wildlife needs to move. So it seems to me the exciting opportunity for rewilding our field is actually about rewilding us as the people who live and yeah. interact with the field. Yeah. So it's really about education, isn't it? And working gently with people to say, could we change our perception of what nature should look like? Can we realise that this lovely, neat, managed, safe representation of the English landscape is actually not how things really work? And that's perhaps something that we can look at again. And I think since, you know, the growth, the explosion really of Extinction Rebellion, of the youth strike movement, of Greta, of David Attenborough.
Mm-hmm. Finally.
Finally going on TV and saying, yeah. actually, yeah, yeah, this is the time now to realise that we're part of nature. We're nature defending ourselves. That's my firm belief. So, can we change our perceptions? And in doing that, can we rewild ourselves by realising that perhaps it isn't all about our own intervention in rewilding the field. It's more maybe about taking a step back, letting the field express itself, observing that, seeing what that looks like, and maybe at some point saying, OK, we could give a helping hand. But I'd really like those decisions personally to be led by the field. Yeah. So that, you know, there's an opportunity where we go, OK, we can intervene a little bit here. We don't have to come in as the saviours, I don't think,
yeah.
and kind of go, this is what we'll do. We have to sort of say, oh, well, let's see what ideas has the field got, if we leave it to its own devices, and how can we be part of that?
I love that project. They're doing such a great thing there. I feel like, I mean, if any of you know the NEP estate, I think I've had Isabella Treaty write a book called Wilding, and it's all to do with rewilding land, and they've done it on a huge scale at NEP estate with 3,000 acres in it. And this is so brilliant because it's a 20 acre spot and they've taken control of it, and now they've got this great project to just let the field guide them as to what it should actually look like. And then they're seeing so much wildlife coming back to it already. Joe went on to say that they didn't mow just one edge of a field, and by not doing that in the summer, they had a barn owl that was back there straight away that was hunting, and they saw it in the evenings in the summer. Just by doing that one small thing, it's so good. I think Rewilding Britain have said they are looking just for 4% of the land in the country to be rewilded, and that would be what could make such a huge difference. It's only 4%, it's 4%, and I think the National Trust own 2%. So it just seems achievable, and just seeing the results that can come along so quickly, it's quite exciting. Maybe we do have a chance, maybe we can claw this back, maybe we can actually be of use. Okay, so we've come to the end of the show. Thank you for listening. I hope you have enjoyed all of the brilliant guests that have been on this month. We've had Jane Mutiny. Find out more about her on janemutiny.com. We had Clara Nissen of the North Fields Allotments. And finally there, it was Joe White at East Chiltington Trust. If you want to find out more about wilding areas, then check out Rewilding Britain if you Google them. Have a look at NEP Estate in West Sussex and Isabella Tree's book, Wilding. And also Sussex Wildlife Trust with Fran Southgate, who is running courses, just introductions to wilding, just to start to get your head around what this kind of stuff is. So check out their website. They've got loads of resources on there as well. If you want to get in touch with me, there are myriad ways. You can do it via Instagram, which is at growingwildfm. Twitter is the same, at growingwildfm. You can email growingwildreverb@gmail.com, or you can go to the show page, which is radioreverb.com/shows, and then you will find Growing Wild in there, and there's a contact form. I love to hear from you. Do get in touch. It's always a pleasure, usually. And no, it is actually. You're lovely. I'll be back next month. Thank you for listening. Until then, go well. And this is Sam Cook with Change Is Gonna Come. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.